but it did. But we're going with it. And we've also had got some problems with the mics in the big studio. So I'm here with Liam in our cozy air room, which is going to change a little bit in terms of taking phone calls, which I'll explain to you. But we did hear, instead of the last 10 minutes of Democracy Now!, a couple songs from Leon Rosselson, my intended theme song for today, Where Are the Barricades?, followed by Looters. That's from his release on PM Press, Where Are the Barricades?, the great English singer-songwriter Leon Rosselson, who I had on live on my folk show about a year ago. All right. And as I said, I've been away. I've been experiencing some difficulties, some personal difficulties. I'm sure lots of you, pretty much all of you, can identify in one way or the other. But just some some emotional stuff that led to some sleep difficulties. Boy, sleep is precious. And I'm so glad that I am feeling better and I'm able to do my show again. Of course, I'm actually going to be going away for 6 weeks after next week's show. And so we're going to have Jacqueline Keeler regularly on the second Wednesday. And you're going to have my relatively new co-host from Portland Assembly on the third Wednesday. And the other shows will be filled by other capable hands and voices. Okay. So, boy, it's grim and getting grimmer, isn't it? The right wingers retrenching on the things that they have control of in the state and the federal government, with the abortion bans increasing, the clampdown on even talking about climate change openly. They're kind of trying to clamp down on any long range prediction of what's going on with the climate. Malaysia has joined China in refusing the tainted recycling. So who knows, we're going to be backed up even further with our obscene plastic garbage that we shouldn't be producing nearly so much of to begin with. And we should have a different recycling system. I remember when I worked at Sunflower Recycling, it seems like eons ago, which is one of the first residential recycling companies. It was a cooperative in the country, and we rigorously, our customers were kind of self-selected because they sort of withdrew from the established garbage haulers and chose Sunflower. So they were already tended to be more conscious and observant, but they rigorously separated everything. We were actually the first ones, we might have been the first one in the country, I don't know, to collect plastic along with the various metals and papers, cardboard and such. And I remember, I think I was the first one to bale up the plastic milk jugs in our baler. That didn't go so well. I put in too many and the bale exploded. Anyway, ancient history here, but yes, I have some personal experience with plastic recycling in addition to many other things. Anybody out there remember Sunflower Recycling? Oh God, what a great outfit. If only Portland had adopted the Sunflower model of recycling, we could have set a shiny example for the nation, Oregon anyway, and perhaps made a change. And basically we separated everything into all the different grades of paper, different kinds of metal, and it made it much more much easier, for one thing, and it was much more valuable, the materials, because they were separated, so that each one was worth more. Okay, enough about recycling. Anybody want to talk about it? You can call up 503-231-8187. We're going to be talking about this youth climate lawsuit, which is finally coming to court again. And June 4th is going to be a big rally to support Juliana versus United States at Director Park here in Portland. That's next Tuesday. And okay, so the problem with the phone calls is Liam is not going to be able to actually answer the phone, otherwise it'll be kind of disruptive. So he's just going to patch you through to the phone patch. So you'll basically just hear yourself being you'll be some sort of click, I think, and you'll be directly on cue. So when I announce the next caller, it'll work out. You'll say your name to me, because I won't know who's calling. And if you're just happen to be calling the 8187 number and don't want to talk on there, please let us know right off the bat, and let's not have a little station conversation. Okay, so this is a press release from our Children's Trust, which is the one that's been doing this lawsuit, the youth climate lawsuit. Oh, I get there's two separate ones, which is kind of confusing. So the Oregon Supreme Court granted the plaintiff's request to take up the youth climate lawsuit against the state. That was just a few days ago, to review the January 2019 Oregon State Court of Appeals decision, and they're asking to reverse that decision, which basically didn't allow it to go forward. But on June 4th, it's going to be actually the Juliana, who's Kelsey Juliana, who's the main youth plaintiff, along with 20 others. And okay, so I'll just read this from 350 PDX. This huge rally on June 4th is a big opportunity to bring hundreds of new people into the climate movement. There will be more than 1,000 people in Director Park. Well, that's what they say. We'll see. Watching the court arguments and supporting the 21 Juliana youth taking the government to court to fight the climate crisis. And so, unfortunately, in my scramble to get ready for the show, I kind of forgot the last minute. I did want to talk about this. Boy, this isn't sounding so great. And I don't actually have the full information. I know this is a major step in this lawsuit, which is basically demanding that the federal government basically institute a formal climate stabilization plan, basically, and basically which would force them to re-examine just about everything that the federal government is doing that has to do with fossil fuel emissions and subsidies and all sorts of other things, and basically bring it in line with the actual science, which says that we need to dramatically reduce in a very, 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 increasingly very short period of time our fossil fuel emissions. So this is a landmark lawsuit that is going forward, and I would hope that someone out you knows more about this and will call into 503-231-8187, because I've got some other information about every day brings new information about the climate crisis. Southeast Alaska is seeing its first extreme drought ever recorded, climatologists say. Alaska's wettest region is experiencing extreme drought for the first time in recorded history. The southernmost portion of Southeast Alaska, including Ketchikan, Prince of Wales Island, Wrangell, and Metlakatla, has been in a drought for the last 2 years, said Rick Toman, a climatologist at the Fairbanks-based Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy. Last week, though, the drought was updated to a D3, or extreme drought, the second highest category the U.S. Drought Monitor measures. It's the first time those conditions have ever been recorded in Alaska, according to the Drought Monitor. Meanwhile, areas experiencing lesser severe and moderate droughts in the panhandle have expanded. This is a rainforest, folks, we're talking about. Then we've got the massive historic flooding continuing in the Midwest. It's been months that these rivers had been at or near flood stages, and they just continue. And just so there's no sign of abating. And then you've got these 43 tornadoes yesterday. Anyway, yes, obviously things are way out of control. At the same time, you know, there's the European Greens have actually gained unprecedented standing in the European Parliament. They're in second place in Germany, third place in France and elsewhere. You know, everybody's talking about this very real populist right-wing resurgence, but they didn't. They actually did gain some, but not much, as much as expected, and didn't continue the huge upswing that they've been seeing in both national and European elections. So That's interesting. Obviously, it's getting through to some people anyway. At least it's been largely reported in the press that it was a kind of a referendum on climate, that was one of the main issues driving the Greens' surge in the vote in the European elections, for the European Parliament. So, lots to talk about. Got some other articles I could refer to here, but I think we have a phone caller. Do we have a phone caller? Yeah, go ahead, you're on the air. Oops, nope, lost him. Let's try the next one. Oh, we lost both of you. Sorry, I guess I talked too much. Okay, 503-231-8187. This is your time. We've got 50 minutes, and I'd like to have a conversation about that or other things that you're thinking about that are going on around the world. 503-231-8187 are the numbers to call. So I also wanted to flag this article about Extinction Rebellion, which is a group that I had on several months ago from the UK. They kind of burst on the scene. They've been having large demonstrations on a fairly regular basis at the Parliament and other places. And but there's some criticisms. You know, there's this, I don't know, I've talked a lot on this show over the years about what I consider these long-standing tensions or conflicts, unresolved differences within the so-called left or progressive movement that I feel are continuing hindrances to us. You know, I was involved in Earth First back in the 1980s, 90s. There was a lot of criticism of Earth First for being rather blind and insensitive to social justice issues, racial issues, gender issues. And all those things were true. And I think there was a lot of people who pushed Earth First from within and the environmental movement in general. I can't say there's been massive shifts. I think there still is a tendency for the environmental movement to be largely white and middle class and somewhat resistant to class issues, is one I mostly want to talk about, because, you know, I've talked about the issue of, you know, do we have to deal with capitalism in order to tackle the climate crisis, or can it be resolved within the climate system, the capitalist system? I come down on the side that I don't think you can separate those issues. And I think Extinction Rebellion, along with a lot of others, are falling in to those same class blindness. So I'm going to read this article. Unlike Extinction Rebellion, I know the harsh reality of prison. It's not about good literature and meditation. This is by Dee Hunter, who is an agency care worker and author of Class Solidarity, or SHAV Solidarity, whatever that means. Anyway, for most of my life, the threat of prison has loomed not far away. I grew up in a kinship network which, in order to materially survive, engaged in illegal activities that regularly led to custodial sentences. During my teens and 20s, days of sex work, street-level drug dealing, and small-time thieving did not pass without the possibility of ending up in custody, and many of us did. I lost nearly half a decade of my life to the prison-industrial complex. At no point did I find transcendence, nor did it mature me, as Extinction Rebellion suggested it might. And it links to an article that an Extinction Rebellion person wrote. What prison did do was further traumatize me and push me down into poverty and violence. As a political organizer and activist in my 30s, I engaged in direct action, and I knew would put me back into custody. Locking myself to diggers at coal mines, blockading arms manufacturers and deportation flights, I knew the likelihood of arrest was high, and a court appearance was very possible. But that prison was unlikely. I was arrested but never charged for other offenses, and sometimes I was just brought in for questioning. I often organized meetings in which plainclothes police would be parked outside my home or the community center at which the meetings were held. All of this stemmed from the choices I made to try and engage with what I viewed to be the structural cause of the existential threat we were facing, namely the economic system of capitalism. During this time, each interaction with the police and the courts was shaped by my identity as a white cisgendered man. They didn't see me as a petty criminal, they saw me as a hippie, a do-gooder, a troublemaker of a different kind. And whatever the psychological experience, the physical experience was not the same as it had been as a young person living in poverty. I'm in favor of communities taking direct action to take control over their lives. I agree with Extinction Rebellion that the environmental threat is a matter of life or death, and direct action must be taken to defend the planet and everything that lives on it. But I cannot fathom an analysis where the prison system is used as a tool to defend the environment, where protesters can recharge with a good book. Whether I think trying to fill up the courts and prisons with climate justice activists is an effective strategy in achieving the required change is not relevant right now. What questions I might have about whether blockading bridges and making policy demands to government constitutes direct action isn't relevant here either. What is relevant are three things. One, the prison system, the judicial system, and the police have physically and psychologically traumatized the poor and working class, and this is doubly so for Black and Asian people. He's talking from an English perspective. Two, the environmental devastation has already begun, and it is physically and psychologically traumatizing poor and working class communities, primarily Black and Asian poor and working class communities. Three, the prison system, the judicial system, and the police are all sides of the same coin as the environmental devastation that has already begun. And using the practices and processes of the former as a tool to end the latter, you'll exclude those most at risk from the movements you're trying to build. I don't write this in order to capture the attention of the organizing committee, spokespeople, and theoretical leaders of Extinction Rebellion. Nothing so far suggests they would listen. I'm writing this to the activists on the ground, some of whom I know, many of whom I am sure are thoughtful and compassionate people who want to defend this planet. I want them to know that they will not find any peace through prison, and the ways in which you find it moving will also scar you for the rest of your life, and negatively affect every personal relationship you have for decades. Being inside prison has become more violent, more isolated, and more psychologically harmful since I was inside. When I was there, I was raped and beaten on a regular basis and had little to no direct contact with the outside world. The friends I have visited over the last decade have turned to substance abuse, self-harm, and in some cases suicide in order to cope with their experiences. The overcrowding, the undertrained staff, and the private companies who penny-pinch to generate a profit have created situations where men and women whose lives have toughened them in the way Roger Hallam couldn't even imagine, I suppose that's the person who wrote the Extinction Rebellion article he's referring to, have been broken inside prison. I would accept the risk of going back to prison, not if I thought a cause was righteous and so in need of action that everything must be risked, but if I thought its strategy was coherent, if it was built on the lived experience of those most affected, and if it did not require making policy demands of states and corporations to remedy their ways. I'd accept the risk of going to prison again if organizations like Wretched of the Earth said, here's a strategy we think will work and it requires people to take that risk. The climate crisis is real and its effects have become a lived reality for many people. Those who are the most affected are the experts. They're the ones who Extinction Rebellion should be taking their cues from, people of color working on the front lines of the climate crisis. I can't be sure, but I suspect that those on the front lines won't tell you that prison is a place for maturing and meditation. Finally, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, Extinction Rebellion is a resource drain on the fight to save our planet. Those of you who have donated your money to it because that is how you believe you can help need to check that you're not just doing that because the people involved, economically secure, university-educated white people, look and sound like you. Harsh words. I don't claim to know what Extinction Rebellion is exactly doing in the United States. I don't claim to say that even his criticisms are all valid in the UK. I just thought that's an interesting perspective, and it resonates with my own feelings, analysis, experiences with what I consider still very naive in terms of its economic and social analysis, environmental movement in the United States. Now, whether or not the youth climate lawsuit is indeed the most effective way to proceed, that's another good question. All these things need to be discussed. I hope they are being discussed. I tend to doubt it. I've, to some extent, opted out for a number of years for various reasons of the direct action environmental movement. I do want to say one thing. As we see an unexpected surge in global methane levels, this is an article from yesterday, which is not a good sign at all. It's in fact a massive releases of methane is kind of the worst of the worst case scenarios that seems to be still there on the cusp potentially. But this is a methane from all sources. So yes, things are dire, getting more dire, both socially and ecologically. Yet, resist we must. And I'm, as I, you know, nothing like coming out of a something of a depression and a personal crisis to make you feel more hopeful on a personal level. And to those of you out there who are in your own difficulties, emotional, psychic, social, whatever, my heart goes out to you. And all I can say is I really agree with Bruce Levine, or Levine, the psychologist I've had on this show, who talks a lot about the need to forge social solidarity and get active in, you know, small, if only small and meaningful to you, ways in helping yourself and others to pull ourselves out of this spiral we seem to be in. So, okay, the reason I bring up a lot of this, also in reference to the Giuliani versus the United States and this the legislative strategy for dealing with climate change to force policy change, is I was just thinking about my own activist experience, and for some reason I've been talking about Breitenbush to some people recently, and I was one of the first tree sitters there at Breitenbush in 1986. But in 1989, this is the 30th anniversary, and I was trying to think when it was. I thought it was around now, but I guess it was in March that 13 people were arrested in a second round of logging protests at Breitenbush. And the reason that I wanted to play that Where Are the Barricades song by Leon Russell, because there were barricades there. It was my first experience of barricades. We did several barricades all along this road leading to the logging operation. And the most memorable was a big, huge pile about, I don't know, 5 feet high with these big, large boulders that people rolled into the road. And Leo Hund, the photo that went around the world, is one of the first photos from the Northwest forest struggle that actually made international news, was carried in papers across the world. I see we got a caller. Hold on just another minute or two. I just want to finish this thought. But so the importance of this is that in the most successful activism that I know of, there was always a two or three track process, including, or four even, but including education, direct action, and litigation. And we did all those and more at Breitenbush, and we ended up protecting that watershed. And, you know, it was a particular time, you know, that there's, for whatever reason, the kind of stars aligned and just a lot of people were getting involved. We were getting a lot of media attention and we were getting success in the courts. But it was because all those things were working together. Plus, you know, some of the more radical and the more mainstream environmental groups were actually working together for a brief period of time. So where is the direct action climate movement now? I know there is, you know, a brief Extinction Rebellion occupation of the tracks there at the Zenith oil train facilities up in North Portland, but it was brief. There needs to be a continual action after action building upon to really get somewhere. And of course, I'm just in an armchair here in a radio booth, but we really do need to step it up. So let's go to our next caller, our first caller. Go ahead, you're on there. Say your name, please. Oh. Let's try one more. Oh. I don't know what's going on. Maybe our phones aren't working. Oh, we got another caller calling in. Let's try this one. Hello? Someone's messing with us. All right, well, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. We've had five blanks. Let's hope the sixth one will do better. All right. So I'm going to read a little bit more from this press release from Our Children's Trust. Came out a few days ago. Kelsey Giuliana, 23-year-old plaintiff from Eugene and also one of the 21 youth plaintiffs in the constitutional climate lawsuit, Giuliana versus the United States, said, "I am left feeling extremely optimistic. I hope that the Oregon Supreme Court will recognize that the climate crisis is here and hold the state accountable to its role in preventing the worst impacts of climate change before it's too late." Courtney Johnson, counsel of plaintiffs and state attorney with the nonprofit Clarag Law Center in Portland, said, "We are thrilled that the state's highest court has recognized the importance of this case and the need to clarify the role of our state government in addressing climate change." Again, this is from a recent decision. The Oregon Supreme Court granted youth plaintiffs' request to review the previous Oregon State of Appeals decision. So in January, the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled that the common law public trust doctrine imposes no affirmative duty on the state to protect public trust resources like beaches in the youth brought climate lawsuit, Chernike versus Brown. Let's try the next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. What's your name?
Michael Shea.
What you got to say?
Are we being sabotaged? What's going on with the democracy now? And the calls, what's going on?
Well, the last 10 minutes were just not there. You know, we the first 50 minutes were there. It's not, no, there's no sabotage. It's just unclear why there were no the last 10 minutes. We're not sure why that was why that happened. As far as the calls, it might be that people are confused that they're not that Liam isn't answering their calls because we're in we're in this air room together because there's a glitch with the microphones in the big studio. So maybe that's what the confusion is. So just to let people know. So I just want to let people know that if you call in, you're not going to get someone answering the phone. So just hang on and wait till I say, "Go ahead, you're on the air." But anyway, what do you have to say?
Well, that's what I wanted to make sure the system's working. That's why I called you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I thank
Great
you.
Great show.
All right.
Excellent show.
Thank you.
You.
Okay. So again, if you want to call and talk to me about anything I've been talking about or other things, if you're not don't want to go there, 503-231-8187. But again, you're not going to get someone to answer the phone directly. He's going to patch you through immediately. Or maybe we should just have you answer the phone. It doesn't really matter. All right. So 503-231-8187. So let me finish reading this. In January, the Oregon State Court of Appeals ruled that the common law public trust doctrine imposes no affirmative duty on the state to protect public trust resources like beaches in the youth-brought climate lawsuit, Chernike versus Brown. The court declined to state which natural resources fall within the scope of the public trust, leaving much of the youth plaintiff's questions unanswered. The case was filed by two young Oregonians in 2011, Giuliana, now age 23, and Chernike, now age 18, brought the case to correct violations of their legal rights and to prevent the irreversible catastrophes facing the state and their futures if climate disruption is not stopped. Their complaint asks that Oregon comply with its public trustee duty to reduce its share of carbon dioxide emissions in line with the scientific prescription to stabilize the global climate at carbon dioxide concentrations below 350 parts per million by 2100. The youth have been supported for the past 8 years by Oregon-based nonprofits, Our Children's Trust, and Crag Law Center. Oregon Governor Kate Brown and Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum continue to defend the state's failure to address climate change, arguing in the case that the state had no legal obligation to the youth to protect state public trust resources from climate change. And that's our Oregon Governor Kate Brown and Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum. The case is one of many related legal actions brought by youth in several states and countries, all supported by our Children's Trust, and all seeking science-based action by governments to stabilize the climate system. Our Children's Trust also supports the climate lawsuit Giuliana versus United States, which was brought by 21 youth plaintiffs, including Chernike versus Brown plaintiff Kelsey Giuliana. All right. So again, that's the Oregon case, and the federal case is going to be in court here in Portland on next Tuesday, June 4th. Unfortunately, I didn't do my full research and get all the relevant information about that, But I do know that people are going to be gathering at Director Park in Southwest downtown Portland at 1:30 on Tuesday, June 4th. So there's also going to be some brief trainings, planning brainstorms, flyer pickup sessions this week. That's today at 3 p.m., tomorrow at 5 p.m., and Friday at 5 p.m. Now you can email Chris at CHRIS at 350pdx.org or text them at 971-712-4152. I'll repeat that information later on. So that's that, and 503-231-8187 is the number to call in here. So coming up this morning, next at 9 on Radio Zine, Suzanne LeGrand talks to Michael Birch, Sal Castaneda Jr., and Nate Wass Scholl about vocational education and apprenticeship opportunities for careers in the trades. At 10 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Rootstock Radio podcast sits down with Amanda Osborne of EcoTrust to discuss her work in helping mid-sized local food producers find their way within infrastructures designed to support the large-scale commodity level or increasingly the small family farm level. Then 11:30 a.m., it's an interview with the co-directors of the Vanport Mosaic Festival. And of course, all these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you haven't yet done so and like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. All right, lots going on. I guess I'll read more about this unexpected surge in global methane levels before I go on to some more personal reflections until someone wants to call and join in. An unexpected surge in global atmospheric methane is threatening to erase the anticipated gains of the Paris Climate Agreement. Well, whether or not there's any real gains expected from that or not is an open question. This past April, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration posted preliminary data documenting an historic leap in the global level of atmospheric methane in 2018, underscoring a recent wave of science and data reporting that previously stable global methane levels, well, that was stable as of between, say, 1997 and 2007-8, according to this graph, and then they started to slowly increase and then much more rapidly increase. Well, let's just hold off on global methane levels and see who's wants to talk to us. Go ahead, you're on the air. Tell us your name.
Hi, my name is Eponymous, and I just want to say that from reliable sources, I feel very confident that some humans will survive this crisis. And I think what we need to do more of is grow our own food for food security, for our health, and for carbon sequestering.
Uh-huh.
Urban farming, setting up eco-villages where people have community gardens as well as individual gardens, food forests, and I applaud all the work that you're doing and the other wonderful concerned people, but I do know that many people are not even aware or are pushing it out of their mind, the crisis.
Uh-huh. No, I've for a long time been a gardener, sometimes larger scale gardener, and I totally agree. I think massive tree planting, all sorts of things, you know, natural sequestration is a strong way to go, but it's clearly not going to be enough. You know, whether or not a few people, to me, it's not much solace that a few humans will survive personally, because we're also taking down massive amounts of the rest of the biosphere, living organisms. Is there's a you know, we're in the sixth great extinction, so right. I don't know. I mean, so I don't know. You're basically taking a sort of a survivalist tact.
Well, no, I'm taking a, I guess, like you said, you've done some gardening, It's a what I tell people is it's cheaper than therapy, and you get tomatoes.
Indeed. I guess my point is that, sure, I think we all should do that, but whether or not it will actually stave off the massive die-off of humans and other species is an open question. So my, you know, I guess I would say in sort of logical terms, it's necessary but not sufficient.
Right. Well, a lot of people feel powerless, but this is a way to maintain your mental health, maintain your physical health, also to help other people. And as you know, in this country, phantom crops, the great big lawns that are so common, a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't realize until I started working with urban farmers, all the volunteer trees that come up when you stop mowing the forest down. That's what they're not mowing the lawn, they're mowing the forest.
Well,
in a temperate rainforest.
Well, it's an ecosystem. There's all the successional types of plants. There's shrubs.
Correct.
There's grasses, shrubs, trees, and it's very interesting to see that happen. I know, I agree with you. I totally agree. I've seen that. I managed a farm, my family's farm in Italy for many years, and it was very interesting to see how the ecosystem tended to express itself where it wasn't. You know, I did suppress it in the orchard, you know, by necessity, because that was, you know, that was sort of my economic basis. But all on the margins, it was an incredibly diverse and rich ecosystem that you could see how it would go if it was just left to its own devices.
Right. And then I feel very strongly that we need to build more community. And we're lucky here in Clark County and also in Multnomah County, there's a lot of community garden plots and a way to meet and share with other gardeners.
Indeed. The Berrydale garden I was part of until I got my own family garden together at my house is up in the Montevilla area, and I bike a lot, so I really love seeing community gardens and love seeing people in there and, you know, chatting with each other. Totally, I'm totally with. I've actually been a community garden for many years myself.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm the first generation. My great grandmother, I heard, had a very good garden, but my grandparents and my parents knew nothing about growing food.
Yeah, that's kind of the historical process that's about the way the generations, that's the whole American way of life sort of took over, and everybody kind of forgot the way we should be living. All right, well, thank you for calling. Looks like we got a couple other people calling in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, let's see who's up next. Go ahead and say your name. You're on the air.
Hello, I'm Edie.
Hi, Edie.
I want to let everyone know that Extinction Rebellion is continuing. We meet in a larger and ever-increasing larger group once a week. We have ongoing nonviolent civil disobedience training, and we have affinity groups, everything from outreach to support to media. I am getting folks together to be our own affinity action medics. We have artwork. We have a variety of different affinity groups who are all sharing leadership in a parallel thing. So look at the Extinction Rebellion Portland website and find out what are the latest gatherings, trainings, slideshows, presentations on how you too can be a part of the solution.
Well, what did you think of the article that was critical that I read?
I was having a hard time getting reception.
Oh, really?
Because I kept calling in and it got snapped, or I would just hear silence from the radio, so I don't know what's going on.
Huh. Okay. Well, I won't read it again, but the title is Unlike Extinction Rebellion, I Know the Harsh Reality of Prison. It's not about good literature and meditation, and is basically a response to something that I didn't read, so it's maybe a little one-sided, but it was basically a critique of environmentalism without a class analysis, basically, without
Well, with extension Portland, there's a clear understanding that we need to be always aware of that and respond to social economic justice. And so those who are setting themselves up to be arrested are doing so with the understanding that different people are treated differently, and those who have the most privilege are going to set themselves up to be arrested while protecting those who would be treated much more harshly or killed.
Right on. That totally makes sense. Great. Well, thanks for calling. So Extinction Rebellion Portland is the name of the website.
Yes, please check it out.
All right. Do you have anything you can on the horizon in terms of activism that you can share with us at the present moment?
Not on the general public to cops listening in.
Fair enough. All right. Well, thanks. Always good to hear from Edie.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Looks like we got another caller. Go ahead. You're up. Who are you?
Name's Mitch, and it's good to hear you back on the air.
Thanks, Mitch.
I just I know that it's not possible to discuss the internal crisis at KABU, but it's apparent and has been apparent for weeks, if not months. And there's a great vacuum of leadership, with station managers being ousted and volunteer coordinators for a station that runs on volunteer labor being suspended. And there's no explanations. There's no voice. There's no. It seems like the community radio is facing extinction, and I'm not. There's this irony in that KABU can give voice to every other movement, but it can't discuss its own crisis and meltdown.
Well, you know, it's strange that my what you're referring to, I actually don't even know enough about. Should I feel free to discuss it, to feel confident? Because my own, as I mentioned, personal crisis sort of dovetailed with whatever it is that's going on. I know something about it, but I even considered making a bold move to. I mean, I don't even know if there's if there's internal conflicts going on or what. So I was going to invite various parties to discuss it, because yes, if there are conflicts going on at KABU, and again, I don't feel either comfortable or confident addressing whatever this issue is, I think people should talk about
I hate to put you in the position of having to risk any discipline, and I don't even know who is meeting out the discipline anymore, since there's no station manager, and the board seems to be split and warring with itself. Most of us on the outside who used to volunteer for KABU don't want to set foot in the building, haven't for years, since we tried to air this the last time. And I just think it's a shame. I'm sorry that all the activists that have been given airtime and a venue by KABU and maybe taken it for granted, because it's more than money that needs to be contributed. I mean, people have to actually care, write letters to editors, even in newspapers that would never cite KABU, let people see that there is, you know, this vacuum. And it's a terrible thing to see. While there are hopeful signs elsewhere, and while there's been good radio on the air that KABU has taken from like KPFA stations and other community radio stations, the fact, just my voice saying the fact that KABU can't deal with its own internal crisis openly in a communicative manner without resorting to the kind of processes of an autocratic government that just issues these
you're saying things that I don't know enough about. I feel a little uncomfortable letting you go on, because I think there's just a lack of good information about what is going on at KABU. That's all I feel like I need to say or can say. And I do think there should be more open discussion. I think there always should be more open discussion. Transparency is what we should be aiming for. And I've been, you know, for the last couple of years, you know, I got involved with the Democratic Socialist of America, and I've been, you know, to some people in that group, I've been saying, hey, you know, it's KBOO, you know, it's a vital resource for the community. This is, you know, our media. We need to, people should get more involved. We need more people involved. And there are a lot of people involved, and I don't want to disparage anybody at KBOO, board, staff, or anybody. I think that your challenge to people to get more involved in the station so that we can work whatever is going on out to the betterment of KBOO and, you know, Portland and beyond, I think that's what I take away from your call. So I thank you for making the call.
Amen to that, and I hope we can resist trying to put white hats and black hats on different volunteers that have kept the station going through the years, because as imperfect as it is, it's still the number one link I send out to people on my media discussion list, because it just deals with things that are vital, and messy as it is, thank God that KBOO had 50 years of maybe imperfect, you know, maybe frustrating, but the only thing of its kind. So thank you for struggling on.
Thanks for calling, Mitch. And I think we got another, no other callers. We've got about 15 minutes left. So if anybody wants to follow up Mitch, 503-231-8187. That's always a difficult kind of call and subject to take on, because as I said, I've been largely out of the station for a couple months, and it's the way KBOO is structured. You know, I don't think this is like airing, I don't think this is a criticism of KBOO. I just think that there's different levels of organization at KBOO, and there's not always the greatest communication between the different levels. And so it's sometimes in any organization, it's difficult to get good information. And if you're, you know, if you're a member, there's the yearly meeting and there's occasional communications, you know. And so if you're a listener, you only get what you hear as a listener. So anyway, I think what Mitch says, regardless of the any specific accusations that he made that I can't comment on, I think is taken in good faith and meant with the best intentions. So, 503-231-8187, that's the number to call in. And here we are. So I was talking about global methane levels. And let's see, last year global methane reached a new historic high, marking the second highest year-over-year jump recorded over the last 20 years. More importantly, the jump in 2018 extended an unanticipated multi-year resurgence of growth in global methane levels and has generated enormous concern in the science community. And I'm reading from climatenexus.org. Scientists report that the new and unexpected methane math threatens to eliminate the anticipated gains of the Paris Climate Agreement, an agreement built upon models that assumed stable methane. Now, this sounds kind of arcane and rarefied, but that sentence is a very, very, very important sentence. I mean, regardless of what you think in general about the possibilities of influencing the fossil fuel economy, reining in emissions, just on the interaction between science and policy, this is very, very key, because a lot of the people I've talked to, some of the cutting edge scientists and observers, have pointed to this, the models that these global climate negotiations are based upon, that largely coming from the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, that there's problems with the models. I mean, the models themselves, the observed data combined with the models leading to projected outcomes are dire enough. They show several degrees of temperature rise baked in to what's already been emitted in terms of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. But the models themselves are not adequate to describe what's going on. And the fact that global methane is rising shows up their problematic nature. So let's go to another caller. Go ahead. Who am I speaking to? Hello?
Hi there. Yeah, hi. So if you could remind me of the prompt, I just tuned in not too long ago, and I'm just just wondering exactly what the prompt was. I heard you say there's 15 minutes left, and Mitch just left, so if there's anyone else out there, and then I dialed up.
What do you mean prompt?
Who are you? What are you asking people to call for?
Well, if you weren't listening, then it's I guess it's hard to. I can't recap everything I've talked about.
That's no problem. I have another question for you.
Okay.
Now. What is something that you wish you knew when you were 20 years old?
I don't know. Just go. Give me the punchline.
That's it. I'm just a young dude looking for some life advice. I'm very lost. But anyways, have a good day, buddy.
Okay. All right, man. Whatever. All right, we got another caller. Go ahead. Nope. Hello, are you on the air?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. What's your name?
This is LJ.
Hello, LJ.
First of all, Paul, it's great to hear you back on the air.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for caring enough about yourself to take care of the beasties in the closet.
Right. That's a nice way to put it. No, it's very apt. It's very apt. There are beasties lurking there that we must heed and pay attention to.
Okay. All right, so here's what we have to address. The fossil fuel industry owns the politicians, right?
Indeed. Well, some of them, yeah. I would say
a great majority of them. I'm afraid, Paul, that a majority of our Congress critters do it for money. And you know what makes that, and you know what people are who do it for money. And they exert an undue influence. So why is it that Europe is way ahead of the curve as far as climate change is concerned?
Well, I don't know how far ahead of the curve they are, actually. I mean, they're as wrapped up in the capitalist economic system as the rest of us. And, you know, there are incremental advantages or incremental differences that are, you know, that allow them to, well, first of all, their parliamentary system allows parties like the Green Party to establish themselves. That's one difference. And so when, you know, enough people get sensitized, you know, if the segment of the U.S. population that was sensitized to the environmental crisis, the climate crisis, had if there was a parliamentary system and we had an actual party that was speaking to it, we would be represented also at, you know, who knows, 15-20% maybe, which would change the calculus of things. But no, we've got a party duopoly, which are both are largely, you know, subsidiaries of big corporations. And yeah, no, that's very true. So that's one big difference that I will grant you.
Okay, again, right, the ruling class refuses to let anybody from the working class have a seat at the table.
Well, yeah, I mean, largely, but people fight for, you know, either getting a seat at the table or overturning the table or doing things, as, you know, building a different table or whatever metaphor what you want to use. Yeah, I mean, we can't wait for them to invite us to their table. That's the first mistake. If people are waiting to
we're meaningless to them. The only thing that the ruling class cares about is our demographic, how much money we're going to spend on Christmas next year, and the tragedy is student loan debt exceeds credit card debt. Students, recent graduates from the so-called university system are essentially indentured servants.
Yeah, and I heard on Fresh Air last night, I do listen to the National Public Radio station, was talking about, had two authors on who wrote a book, the Stressed of Times or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was about the mental health crisis at the universities. It's the anxiety levels are just off the charts.
Of course they are. They have to be. Paul, damn it! If you're going to be if you're going to graduate from college in debt for $30,000-$35,000.
Well, that's a big part of it. It's not the only part of it. It's also a lot
of
the pressures.
No. It of course it's on like more than one level. I'll give other people a chance to talk. I just want to remind the audience, my KBOO brothers and sisters, that democracy and capitalism are incompatible with each other. You could have one or the other, but you can't have both.
All right.
Paul, keep on keeping on, man.
Okay, thank you, LJ.
Paul,
right on.
You're the man, Paul.
okay. Enough.
You're the man.
All right, yeah. okay. Yeah. Thank you, LJ. All right, The Stressed Years of Their Lives is the name of the book. So that's another thing. Anyway, yes, I think as things do continue to spin, spiral in negative directions, I think we will see more mental health crises. So next week, we are going to hear from Molly Dumars. Oh my gosh, I forgot to get more information about her. I'm going to get back on track here, folks, but bear with me. So Rethinking Psychiatry, who I've had on a number of times, and have their first Wednesday event on my first Wednesday, day of my first Wednesday show. Their event next week at the Montevilla United Methodist Church is going to feature Molly Dumars. And I didn't print out the information here. Maybe Liam can write it down. Anyway, she's involved in an organization with, I believe, peer recovery. It's a different approach to recovery from mental health issues. And that's going to be next week on this program, Molly Dumars. Sorry, Molly, I didn't do my homework and get more information. But that's what we'll be talking about. And it's a timely subject. I think everybody's feeling, certainly the state of the world has contributed to my emotional instability over the last couple months. As someone told me, since I do have a microphone, I think the fact that I'm able to talk about, a little bit about what's going on with me maybe gives people a feeling possibly that they're not so alone. I mean, to me, it's amazing if people do feel that they're alone in whatever they're going through, because millions and millions of people are experiencing serious mental and emotional difficulties. And as I said, it's not getting any better with the Trumpism and with the climate crisis and now with the rabid right-wing conservative clamp down on women's rights and women's reproductive rights. So with that, I think we got to get out of here. Thank you, Liam, for riding with my first day back and with some technical difficulties. And I'll be talking to you next week. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center in Portland. Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, is a public talk by Grace Kim about the loneliness epidemic in Portland and how co-housing can help. Grace is a principal at Skamata Workshop and a co-founder of Capitol Hill Urban Co-Housing in Seattle. The talk is part of the National Co-Housing Conference taking place in Portland, May 30th through June 2nd. Again, that's Co-Housing, Creating Community, One Neighborhood at a Time, on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO May Board of Directors meeting will happen on Monday, June 3rd at 6 p.m. because of the Memorial Day holiday. The June board meeting will take place at the regular date and time, 6 p.m. on the fourth Monday of the month.
My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and I'm here with three advocates for vocational education, Michael Birch, Sal Castaneda Jr., and Nate Washul. To start, I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what you do and why, starting with Michael.
My job is community relations and outreach, and part of that is teaching educators, teaching kids and parents about the opportunities that exist in the construction trades. My specific area is carpentry, but all the trades offer great careers if they're union trades. My mission, my passion is to work with any and everyone who will listen about the opportunities that exist, and that this is the other four-year college. You don't have to pay to go to a four-year, five-year college and owe money. You can earn money as you go. It's on-the-job training, and it's education for life. Great benefits, great pay, and great retirement, great pension.
My name is